Hey, it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The city of Whitewater entered the national political spotlight last year after its police chief, Dan Meyer, wrote a letter to President Biden asking for federal resources to support an influx of immigrants in the community.
Former President Trump went on to reference the city during campaign rallies in Wisconsin, using it as a means of criticizing the Biden administration's border policy.
But the political rhetoric doesn't tell the whole story of immigration in Whitewater. So journalists at the nonprofit ProPublica spent months talking to local leaders and community members to get a more complete picture.
Melissa Sanchez and Mariam Jamil are reporters for ProPublica. Their new story on Nicaraguan immigrants in Whitewater was just published this morning. Mariam, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
And Melissa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Melissa, ProPublica is doing an investigative series on how immigration is experienced in the U.S. What led the two of you into Whitewater in particular?
Well, Mariam and I, for the past couple of years now, have been reporting from Wisconsin, focused largely on immigrants who work on dairy farms. And we'd noticed, you know, a couple of years ago, right from the start, that the city of Whitewater kept popping up in unexpected ways. Whitewater isn't a place where there's dairy farms. It's more of an urban area. But a lot of the immigrants who had been working on dairy farms were starting to shift jobs and move into factory work into places like Whitewater. And so we became interested in it a while ago, and it was just kind of on our radar. And when the chief wrote a letter to Biden last year and it got all that attention back in January, it just made sense to kind of pause and see what was actually happening there.
Mariam, what can you tell us about the Nicaraguan immigrants who, as Melissa just mentioned, are in some cases moving off of dairy farms and into industrial jobs in Whitewater? What kind of demand is there for their labor? What kind of work are they doing?
Yeah, they're working in a number of different type of mostly manufacturing and food production jobs. So there's an egg farm in the area. There's a packaging company. There is a toilet part manufacturing company. There's a company called there's a company that focuses on power manufacturing. They are companies that are inside Whitewater and slightly outside, often 20 to 30 minutes out of the city, and it makes Whitewater a great hub to settle in because there's more housing available in the city than in some of the surrounding towns and rural areas.
Melissa, you mentioned the police chief, Dan Meyer, writing that letter to the White House, and this it immediately gets drawn into the national political conversation. You spent a lot of time talking to Chief Meyer there. What were his feelings about how his letter was treated in national politics versus what he was really facing from day to day?
I mean, I think he was really taken aback by what was happening. He has this line he always says, like, I'm just trying to do my job. He was just trying to get resources. He's a guy who really avoids politics as much as he can. He's glad he's not in an elected position. Like, you know, we asked him many times, like, who are you voting for? And he's just is disinterested. He hates politics. So to see this, like, from what we could tell, like a really pragmatic, like attempt to get resources for a department that was already short-staffed before the Nicaraguans came, to see that become like a big political spectacle and draw a lot of negative attention to the city, I think was really discouraging. And so, you know, he doesn't wear his feelings on his sleeve, but he wasn't happy about what he was seeing from either party. And like, he made that very clear. He's like, leaders from both sides have really disappointed him.
Mariam, in the national conversation, this is sometimes treated as, aha, a police department is overwhelmed by these migrants and a wave of crime that's following them. That wasn't there, the violent crime. A very common problem, though, that Chief Meyer and others cite in your reporting is driving. An inability of many of these migrants to get a driver's license. When you were talking to people in the Nicaraguan immigrant community in Whitewater, how big a challenge was this in their lives?
It's a huge challenge for people. Some of the Nicaraguans are technically eligible to get a driver's license because they're asylum seekers, but the steps required to do that from getting paperwork, often they need their Nicaraguan IDs that have been confiscated from them at the border, often to just like the literacy required to take a driver's license test are huge obstacles. And for them, this isn't a place where you're most likely going to be able to walk to your job. You need to use a car to get groceries, to just live your life, to get to work. And the police are often not necessarily looking for people who might be driving without a license, but they scan licenses as a routine part of their job, license plates, and then they see that vehicles are registered to somebody who doesn't have a driver's license, and they end up pulling over and ticketing that person. And then we actually did a couple of ride-alongs with police officers to understand better firsthand. And we saw how, because somebody might be either not handing over an ID or giving an ID that doesn't have their real name, it turns into a process, a multiple hours long process to really sort out who it is that they've pulled over to be able to issue a ticket, in addition to the language barriers that they're working through with a translator while they do their policing. So it's a huge issue.
And Melissa, go ahead, Melissa.
Oh, sorry. No, just one thing to add that was really striking, I think, to people in Whitewater when we told them is that the vast majority of the Nicaraguans we interviewed come from these itty bitty rural communities up in the mountains in northern Nicaragua, in places where people don't drive. People walk or they get around on mule or horse because the roads are so bad and people are so poor. Nobody actually owns a vehicle. So a lot of the people we talked to learned how to drive in Whitewater. One person in town kind of described it as being bumper cars at the beginning, because people were making mistakes, not huge mistakes that were leading to pedestrian fatalities or anything, but they were learning how to drive as they went. And so sometimes people were getting pulled over, like Mariam explains, with these random checks of the plates. But sometimes, the main person we focused on, this man named Mariel, he went straight through an intersection from a left turn lane, which isn't, the worst mistake in the world, but it was something that caught the attention of a police officer who then pulled him over.
Talking to Melissa Sanchez and Mariam Jamil with ProPublica and the reporting on Nicaraguan immigrants in Whitewater. Mariam, in the piece, you also talked to community members, locals who were there watching Nicaraguan migrants move into the community. Wide variety of reactions. What kind of things were you hearing?
Yeah, I would say the strongest feeling that we heard from people in Whitewater, which is a city that leans slightly liberal, where people were really happy to see that their population was becoming more diverse while also trying to rush to find ways to help the new population adjust. So for instance, one group is making videos to teach newcomers kind of things that I think would be obvious to a lot of people who grew up in the U.S. in most places, things like you need to call in absences if you're going to school, if your kid won't be going to school, things like how to grocery shop effectively and bring carts back to the store, little things like that folks are seeing people struggle with. I think there's a lot of anger around how politicized the issue in Whitewater became. Folks were frustrated to hear former President Trump describing a level of crime that wasn't actually happening in their community. There are also folks who are more conservative who have raised issues with the seeing the new population of folks who do not speak English, kids who do not speak English in their schools, and have raised concerns about what effect that's having on education for other students. One conservative member of the community that we spoke with, Chuck Mills, who's quoted in our story, he described initially being really scared of what the new population would do to Whitewater, because he'd seen larger cities on TV where you had homeless folks on the streets, you had cities that were really overwhelmed in a quite significant way. But he described starting to get to know his new neighbors and finding that really the fears weren't what he had imagined initially, and that everything is fine.
And that makes me think a big point of this report, as I read it, Melissa, is we can quickly form these stereotypes of what's going on in a community like Whitewater, whatever our political persuasion. When you see things on the ground, Melissa, things look pretty different. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, it's sort of the conclusion I think we came up with, which isn't a giant investigative finding, but it's complicated. Like, it's just complicated. Humans make mistakes and they do bad things and they do good things, and like all of us. And I think that's what we've seen with the immigrants in Whitewater. Some of them like have made mistakes and like even driven drunk, like the main character who we have in the story, Ariel. But the vast majority of the issues that we're seeing are not significant. Like there haven't been any major serious, like a serious crime wave. And one thing that was interesting to us, I guess, from the start is that both on the left and on the right, there wasn't a lot of direct interaction with the immigrants themselves. And part of that's because of the language barrier. A lot of the good, well-meaning people in Whitewater who are really helping immigrants, like they don't speak Spanish. So they don't actually, they aren't capable of having like in-depth conversations with these folks. So we really hoped that this story, which relies like on interviews with dozens of Nicaraguans, can help people understand like where it is that these folks are coming from and what their experiences have been in the city.
And Mariam, where are you going next when it comes to covering immigrants' experiences here in Wisconsin?
That's a great question. Our inboxes and phones are open if anybody wants to share tips with us. We are very plugged into Wisconsin, but I don't think we've quite decided what our next story is.
Well, we'll leave it there for now. Mariam, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
And Melissa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Melissa Sanchez and Mariam Jamil. They are reporters for ProPublica. Their new piece out today looks at the politicization of immigrants in Whitewater. We'll have a link to their reporting up at WPR.org. And if there's something going on in your community that you'd like an organization like ProPublica or Wisconsin Public Radio to cover, to focus in on, we would love to hear from you what you're seeing, what you'd like to hear reported on. You can email us, wisconsintoday@WPR.org. Again, that's Wisconsin Today. Schmoosh it together is all one word, at WPR.org.
Coming up, the politics bureau chief at Politico is a journalist in residence at UW-Madison and says when Americans can't agree on the same set of facts, reporters are in a tight spot.
But we have no choice. We have to inform the electorate and we have to give voters the basics about who the candidates are and what they stand for, even if that is more challenging now than ever.
Election coverage ethics, that's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This election year, Wisconsin Public Radio is asking people across the state what would they want the candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes. Several audience members said healthcare access in rural areas should be part of the conversation.
As Bridget Bowden reports, the issue hits close to home in western Wisconsin, where hospitals and clinics closed earlier this year.
Kathy Topaski has lived in Augusta, Wisconsin for about 30 years. She says the small town outside of Eau Claire is a close-knit community.
Everyone knows everyone and probably all their neighbors, all of their friends, and all of the brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles.
Topaski says lots of people there see the doctor at the local clinic and have for years. That is, until the clinic abruptly closed earlier this year. Hospital Sisters Health System and Prevea announced a complete exit from western Wisconsin in January, which included closing two hospitals and 19 clinics, including Augusta's. Topaski says the town was shell-shocked.
We knew these people, not just as the front desk receptionist or the nurse that took care of us, but we knew them, we knew their families, we knew where they lived, we knew all of those things just from being in the community.
According to a recent report by the healthcare consulting firm Chartis, more than 400 of America's rural hospitals are vulnerable to closure. Rural residents also face obstacles like longer drives and less access to specialty care. But healthcare isn't an issue that's top of mind for many voters in this year's election. In the latest Marquette University Law School poll, only 5% ranked it as their top priority. Tom Oliver is a professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says it's not that healthcare isn't important to voters, it just doesn't always make for the best talking points and political ads.
Lots of health issues out there, just not the things that grab everybody's attention and that people want to funnel billions of dollars behind into a whole campaign.
He says voters tend to connect more with issues they see as black and white, right or wrong. And healthcare problems and solutions are more complex than that.
You know, the hope for something better doesn't quite compete with the threat of something being taken away.
But healthcare is top of mind for some voters who live in areas where it has been taken away, like Western Wisconsin. Democratic State Representative Jody Emerson is running for another term in the district that includes the Augusta Clinic.
People are struggling to get a new doctor if their primary care doctor was in one of the clinics that closed. People are having to wait a really long time to get in for just basic medical care.
Emerson believes expanding Medicaid would help address the problem. Wisconsin is one of just 10 states that haven't accepted this federal funding. Her Republican opponent, Michelle Skinner, didn't respond to requests for an interview. But in a written response to WPR's candidate survey, she said she would focus on increasing competition rather than expanding Medicaid. In Augusta, Topaski and others worked hard to find a way to reopen their clinic.
We had banners and we had posters and we had yard signs, and we just pretty much papered the entire town with these.
They contacted their elected officials and sent dozens of letters to healthcare companies.
We wanted to make sure that all of the people here, those seniors, those children, those pregnant women, those families, all of those people had access to healthcare.
Eventually, they found North Lakes Community Clinic. The group is reopening the clinic with primary care and behavioral health services, and even hired the same doctor who worked there before. North Lakes CEO Reba Rice says Augusta is thrilled to have the clinic back. They even made new yard signs that say, "Welcome, North Lakes."
They really were like, "No, this is our community, and we deserve health care, and we're going to get it."
Rice says it's going to take both sides of the political aisle to get better healthcare access for all rural communities.
If we're going to make any headway, we have to do it together. We can't be one party or another party.
And that's what she hopes to see candidates talking about heading into November. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Wisconsin Today.
With the November general election just days away and early voting underway here in Wisconsin, the presidential candidates and their surrogates are barnstorming battleground states like ours.
The Democratic National Committee Chairman Jamie Harrison told WISN-TV recently that all the eyes of the nation are on Wisconsin.
And media outlets from around the country and the world are taking stock and filing stories from all corners of the state.
That includes Jonathan Martin, a politics bureau chief and senior political columnist at Politico. He is visiting Wisconsin this week as the journalist in residence at the UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics. And he's here with us to talk about what he's seeing, both on the ground and from a bird's eye view. Jonathan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
It's great to be here and a thrill to be in Badgerland. Thanks for having me.
And you are in the throes of a battleground state here Indeed. In Wisconsin this week. The big theme of your visit is about media ethics
yes.
and how to cover the election ethically, especially given the increasing polarization that we're seeing. What does it mean to cover this election ethically?
Well, it's never been harder, at least in modern times, to cover politics because fewer and fewer people can agree on facts. We all grew up in an era of post-World War II consensus politics, media, and culture. And to put it in football terms, use a seasonal topic or seasonal metaphor rather, everything was kind of between the 40-yard lines. And that is different now. We're in a more fractured, fragmented culture, and everything it's more like the 19th century than it is the second half of the 20th century. That's a long way of saying if we can't agree on the basic facts, then it's hard to have arguments because we can't even get to different opinions. We can't even agree on facts. The internet has made it harder. Social media has made it harder yet. But we have no choice. We have to inform the electorate, and we have to give voters the basics about who the candidates are and what they stand for, even if that is more challenging now than ever.
Our producers were out on campus this week talking with students about their perspectives on voting. And Joseph from Lake Geneva says that as a younger voter, he sees a lack of understanding from politicians about technology and how his generation is interacting with social media. Let's have a listen.
I think there's a lot of problems, especially with disinformation and misinformation, that it seems like a lot of politicians are aware of, but don't seem fully equipped to address and or don't have proper guidance for addressing.
How should politicians handle the spread of misinformation and the deliberate spread of false information?
Well, let's cut to the chase here. One of our two nominees for president is a purveyor of disinformation. Donald Trump pushes information that's not true. I can cite you chapter and verse. The most obvious example being that Haitian migrants in Springfield, Ohio. Your listeners know that story. I don't have to belabor it. So it's tough when you've got one of the two nominees as sort of a purveyor of disinformation. How do we cover an era of politics and government when people do not believe the basics, when people are susceptible to believe, for example, the government bioengineered a hurricane? Well, it's pretty darn tough, and it's getting harder yet. I've been speaking to students this week here at UW in classes, in lecture halls, and in conversations on the side, and this comes up over and over again, which is, when people all have kind of their own version of reality, how do we go into journalism? How do we cover campaigns? How do we cover government? And it's not easy. What worries me is the pace of the technology is outdoing the speed of the solution. So I say that. Let's say that the government, state or federal, decides to regulate social media. We decide that the algorithms are just pushing people into their versions of reality, and we have to crack down on social media and the algorithms. Well, that's going to take years, right? And what I worry about is by the time that that happens, there's going to be some new technological wave that we're going to have to address, and we'll be fighting the last war instead of the current one.
Well, let's turn to the Trump campaign. Journalists have struggled to cover Trump since he first announced that he was running for president in 2015. That's over 9 years ago.
Right.
There is a tension between taking him literally versus taking him seriously.
Yes.
So what do you think the media has learned about covering Trump over the past decade?
We haven't fixed it. We haven't figured it out. I mean, you're right. It's been over 9 years. Trump has effectively broken the system because the system that we had in place, the sort of AP-style candidate X said X, candidate Y said Y today. Straightforward, again, between the 40-yard lines, it just doesn't work for him because you have to basically grade him on a curve to do that kind of journalism. So you're left in a situation where if you cover him for what he is and you're honest about the aberrant nature of his candidacy and his conduct, then you write in a way that's breathless, that's Pearl Harbor-style headlines and coverage. And you exhaust the reader and you desensitize the reader or the viewer. And you also, you prompt claims of bias. You just hate Trump. You don't like Trump. Okay, if you don't cover him for what he is, if you grade him on a curve, if you try to pretend like this is Bob Dole, Bill Clinton, 1996, then you're doing your readers a disservice because you're not being truthful, which is the coin of our realm, about the nature of his candidacy and his political movement. So there's no easy answer because either approach creates huge challenges.
It's kind of rock between a rock and a hard spot. So,
indeed,
you know, as the election approaches, there's a growing number of Americans concerned about the possibility of election fraud.
Yes.
And NPR's public editor says NPR aims to be a common denominator of calm through measured reporting. And it's just not the role of public media journalism to get people riled up.
Yes.
Is this a sound journalistic approach in these times?
I think it is. I think having sober reporting on just the facts, on being straightforward and unadorned, but also not grading on a curve and saying straightforward that if there's no evidence of voter fraud in this community, then just say it outright. I think that's a good thing. And I think people depend on outlets like NPR to do as much. So, I would applaud that decision. You don't have to try to pretend something that's normal that's not. You don't have to say, well, candidate X said the moon's made of cheese today. And no, that's not true. It's not made of cheese. If there's not evidence of voting fraud, just say
it's cheese.
Well,
and you're in Wisconsin.
Uh-oh. I'm exactly. sacred cows here, as it were.
Let's talk about ad spending. Election day ad spending. Wisconsinites, you know, you are being inundated with campaign ads as you walk the turf here.
Yes.
You know, it's the mailers and the commercials, the text messages, the social media. Ad spending set to break records.
Yes.
Total spending projected at $10.2 billion. That's from Ad Impact, the ad tracking platform.
Yeah.
Do these dollars translate into higher turnout?
Yes, they wouldn't spend the money if it didn't have some ROI, return on investment. The reason they do it is because it works. It's the oldest one in the book. Why do these politicians sling mud? Why do they do these negative ads? They do it because it works. If there was a backlash to it, if it hurt them, they wouldn't do it. The name of the game is getting votes. They're going to do whatever it takes to get votes. And so, yeah, I think the fear is you know, disarmament, and maybe TV doesn't matter as much. We're going to cut our buy in half. Well, what if the other guy doesn't? Are you giving that person an advantage? So that's always the fear, is one-sided disarmament, because then you're handing the other side the advantage. So, yeah, the arms race goes on, and it gets more expensive every election, and they're going to find more and more mediums to reach voters.
We're discussing media coverage of the election with Jonathan Martin. He's politics bureau chief at Politico, where he reports from all around the country, writes about the big picture trends shaping politics. And he's here in Wisconsin this week as the journalist in residence at the UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics. Now, you've been on the ground here in Wisconsin.
Yes.
You're getting a feel
yes.
for this battleground
yes.
state as the campaigns just, you know, barnstorm, if there's an even bigger word for barnstorm. The Democratic National Committee chairman has said in recent days, all eyes of the nation are on our state ahead
yes.
of Election Day. What are you observing about Wisconsin compared to the other six swing states?
So here's my anecdotal report. I've spoken to about five classes so far. I've asked the kids to raise their hand if they're voting in Wisconsin. What's striking to me is when I ask that question in the classes, almost all the hands shoot up. These kids, whether they're native Wisconsinites or they're in school here from somewhere else, they're registering to vote here because they know the power of their vote. And the other thing that's striking is I don't find, at least folks admitting it, that there's any flirtation with Jill Stein. You know, she got, I think, nearly a couple thousand votes here in 2016, very left-wing community. And you don't see that this time, which is telling and I think significant.
In your recent column for Politico, you talk about bipartisanship as the winning move for the Harris campaign and that she should do more to signal to voters that she would govern from the political center. What would this look like? What would this strategy look like?
I think that, and I saw her and Liz Cheney on Monday night together in suburban Milwaukee, sort of Waukesha County, classic Republican suburb.
Mm-hmm. Wow County.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But there's voters up for grabs there now because they don't like Trump's style of Republicanism. So she's trying to pick up those George W. Bush Republicans. And I just think that she's got to do more because criticizing Trump as a bad man who did the wrong thing on January 6th and is unfit for office and of ill character. If you are voting based on those things, if you already believe those things, you're almost certainly already voting for Kamala Harris. The voters she needs that are still up for grabs are those that maybe they think Trump's a bad man, but they want more from Harris about her and how she would govern. And frankly, they want reassurance that she'd be a moderate. And I think there's ways she can do that. She can talk about the bills that she would work on with Republicans, talk about her agenda, ways to compromise. Yes, use the C word. Say compromise. Americans, I think a lot of them are dying for the two parties to work together. And I think it's in her interest to say, America, the dirty little secret is that a lot of Republicans are tired of Trump, too. So are you, and so am I. Let's work together to get stuff done. I think that kind of signaling and mention a couple of names of lawmakers that you'd work with or even appoint, I think that can go a long way to cueing those kind of remaining voters in the center who don't want to vote for Trump, but maybe they're not sure they can pull the Democratic lever yet because right now, they may write somebody in or they may skip the top line. Don't forget, in Wisconsin in 2020, I think like 70,000 voters did not vote in the top line, but voted in the rest of the ticket. Hmm. That's a lot of people who couldn't bring themselves to vote Trump or Biden last time.
Trump won large majorities among rural voters in 2016, further consolidated the rural vote in 2020, and Hillary Clinton famously did not visit Wisconsin during the 2016 campaign.
Infamy!
And now it feels like a reversal leading up to 2024. So, you know, as journalists, it feels like we parachute into rural areas to describe what's happening with voters. How do you view the rural vote in this cycle?
I think it's going to be difficult for Kamala Harris to do much better than Biden did, and she may do a little bit worse. Look, there are broader structural trends shaping American politics that Trump has accelerated, but that I think are bigger than Trump. And there is what's called education realignment. A lot of your listeners will understand this. The shorter way of saying it is that suburbanites, traditional center-center right voters are more open to voting for Democrats now on cultural grounds. They simply don't recognize what the Republican Party is. Old school Democrats, folks whose parents were, you know, FDR or Kennedy Democrats, are more open now to voting for Republicans on cultural grounds. People don't vote their pocketbook necessarily. Culture matters on both sides. And I think that is what is shaping politics in a way that the map of Wisconsin going forward would be very unfamiliar to people who grew up in Wisconsin, where you saw these traditional Democratic labor communities that are now red. And you saw a lot of the kind of upscale, communities that were always Republican that are much more split now. And I think that's only going to accelerate.
Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. On Wisconsin.
That was Jonathan Martin, politics bureau chief and senior political columnist at Politico, talking about media coverage of the election and political trends he's seeing while visiting Wisconsin as the journalist in residence.
Coming up, meet a Wisconsin actor and filmmaker who played a role in the brand new Ojibwe language translation of the original Star Wars movie.
You could feel the excitement. You could feel the pride of hearing our language on the big screen.
A galaxy far, far away and a language close to home. That's next on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Pickleball lovers, listen up. A new outdoor pickleball park in western Wisconsin is open to the public.
The 18-court complex opened this summer in Lake Halley. That's near Eau Claire. And players are flocking to play one of the fastest-growing sports in America.
Wisconsin Today producer Courtney Everett recently spoke with project manager Bill Bethke about the sport, the new facility, and ongoing improvements.
You're an avid pickleball player. Now you've created one of Wisconsin's largest pickleball facilities. Are you just living the dream here?
The dream was a little more work than I expected, but no, it was great. It's a great legacy to give to the Chippewa Valley. There's been a lot of people involved in the project, obviously, to make this come to fruition.
Take us inside Lake Halley's pickleball park. What's the atmosphere like there?
The courts are packed by 8 a.m. in the morning. People are playing routinely till usually about 11 to 12 o'clock. And then there's a little bit of a lull where probably only half the courts are utilized. And then once again in the evening, after work, people are again filling the courts.
Earlier you mentioned the group of people that you worked with to develop this court system that includes the Chippewa Valley Pickleball Club, as well as the Village of Lake Halley to develop these $300,000 worth of courts. How did the idea of this 18-court system come about?
Well, it started really about a year and a half ago. We were first looking at, they had an old park which was really underutilized. It was called Gower Park. It was an old playground which was pretty dilapidated and a softball field which was barely ever used. Actually, a lot of weeds were growing in it. And we looked at the site, and I reached out to Gary Splide, the president of the Village of Lake Halley. And from there, he said, yeah, why don't you turn it into pickleball courts? So we came up with the bids, and Dave Marcourt and myself worked together on getting those first six developed into permanent pickleball courts. At the ribbon cutting, Gary came up to me last June, and he said, Bill, how many more courts can you fit in this park? That's where the story began.
You say, Bill, that there are efforts underway now to build a pavilion near the pickleball courts. Tell us about that phase of construction and what you hope to accomplish.
Six of the 18 courts are lit. In order to control and generate power to them, we needed a building. And that was part of phase two. And I reached out to Markin and Johnson to build a two-bathroom unisex ADA-accessible bathrooms, a mechanical room, and then an open pavilion with a water fountain and some picnic tables for people to meet. So that our goal is to be completed yet this fall.
Now, speaking of fall, how long do you expect players to play until, with the weather now getting colder?
We all prefer to play outside. Once the weather turns, obviously, then we either fly south or we go to two indoor facilities. Actually, I had a meeting earlier with a group about possibly building an indoor center here in the Chippewa Valley.
Ooh, tell me a little bit about that indoor center. What's kind of going on there?
Well, it's just in its infancy. We are talking about 12 indoor pickleball courts going also in Lake Halley, very close to the existing 18 courts. They just finished building an indoor center in Madison, and the same company's got one slated to be built in Green Bay and Milwaukee as well.
Before we go, what do you hope this new pickleball complex then brings to Western Wisconsin next year as far as tournament play?
Well, first of all, as far as bringing the Western Wisconsin, I like the fact that the pickleball complex, all the funds were donated. A big check came, obviously, from the Village of Lake Halley, and then Dave Marcourt gave a significant amount, even more than the Village did. And then lots of businesses, everything from, obviously, Markin and Johnson, Chippewa Valley Orthopedics, and a plurality of other donors. My original vision was having a place where people could play for free. So there's no cost for man, woman, or child to go out there and enjoy themselves. And it's a game you can learn very quickly. We're probably going to be hosting a tournament a month is our goal at the site starting in May. But we have a big one, a national tournament that we are going to be hosting in July, at the end of July, which will be bringing pro athletes to the Chippewa Valley, and it will be the biggest outdoor tournament in the state.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Courtney.
Bill Bethke is the project manager of an 18-court pickleball park in Lake Halley, Wisconsin. The outdoor complex opened in July of this year. He talked to producer Courtney Everett.
Yes, a new version of the original Star Wars will be available soon on Disney Plus. But instead of May the Force be with you, you'll hear
Giga Minigos Mamandawazuin.
That's Nigani Anamiki Anini sharing the pivotal line from Star Wars in the Ojibwe language.
He reprises the role of Red Leader in the new Ojibwe language translation of the movie. He is a filmmaker and a member of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians.
He's here with us today to tell us about playing Red Leader and what it means to have a major pop culture milestone available in Ojibwe. Nigani, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to talk about your connection with Star Wars. You know, depending on generation and time and place, some people it might be a very cherished childhood memory. For some people, just part of the scenery. Some people, Star what? Where were you on that when this opportunity came along to be part of the Ojibwe version of Star Wars?
Well, I first watched Star Wars when I was a child back in the 90s. They did the re-edit of the original 4, 5, and 6 episodes before those 1, 2, and 3 episodes came out. And I was a big fan Not one of these huge fans where you have to have every toy, every costume, but I really enjoyed the films. And so when this opportunity came, being a film producer, wanting to grow into acting and voice acting, being a fan of Star Wars, and of course, being really involved with Ojibwe language revitalization, is a no-brainer to apply.
Nagani, as you understand it, how did this Ojibwe dub of Star Wars come about, and what was the goal behind it?
Well, you know, Pat Nangawansa's dream, this elder, this Ojibwe elder from north of the Medicine Line, north of the U.S.-Canadian border, that within several decades, us Ojibwe folks, we can do anything we want in our language. Not just go to ceremony, but go to the grocery store, go to school, watch our favorite films. Anything that we want to do that we can do in English or in French, we can also do in Ojibwe. And this is just one great milestone, great step in that trajectory of Ojibwe language revitalization.
So you play in the movie Red Leader, a pivotal role in the battle in the trenches and the Death Star off of Yavin 4. Tell us a little bit about the role and what it took for you to recreate that.
So I give voice to Red Leader, played on screen by the late Drew Henley. And to prepare myself for this role, I watched that section of the film multiple times, and I did some research. I learned that Mr. Henley had negotiations with George Lucas and how he wanted to portray this character. And it was Mr. Henley's understanding that this is a really well-experienced military commander, a military man who's not going to be emotional in battle. And so he wanted this person to be really stern and emotionless. But George Lucas wanted much more drama in the emotions. And so they negotiated. And in the film, Red Leader is calm and collected in the beginning. And then towards the end of this battle scene, as things get particularly hairy, some emotions come in. More unnervedness, if you will. And so I brought that into the studio, and I did my own negotiations with our own director in expressing those types of emotions.
I understand you went to the August premiere in Winnipeg. What was it like experiencing this movie in Ojibwe and with your own voice in it?
Oh, it was wild. It was wild. And just the weight of the moment, right? This film is the first major Hollywood film dubbed in the Ojibwe language. I hope the first of many, the first of all Hollywood films to be either produced or dubbed in the Ojibwe language. And that, and everybody was feeling it, right? It was a very large theater, hundreds of folks, many of whom, most of whom were fellow Anishinaabek. And you could feel the excitement. You could feel the pride of hearing our language on the big screen. It was a fabulous time.
We are talking about the Ojibwe language dubbed version of Star Wars with Nagani Ananimaki Anini. He is a filmmaker, a member of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians. He played the role of Red Leader in that dub. You just mentioned, Nagani, the excitement in the room, in the theater, as you watched this. What are your hopes now that future generations can experience this language, as you said, maybe not just in a ceremony, but sitting down to watch Star Wars and maybe more movies to come?
Absolutely. So I hope this film inspires more people, including young people, to either continue learning our language or to begin learning our language.
What does it mean for a language learner to have, you know, maybe not just that ceremonial language, but this fun element of pop culture in learning a language?
One, you can do anything in our language. Our language is just as modern as anyone else's. And a lot of studies show if you're having fun learning a language, it's going to be that much easier for you.
So this is not the only work you've done in promoting the Ojibwe language. You've done this in other venues as well. Why is it important to you to help bring back the Ojibwe language? What does it mean to you to have it more widely understood and spoken?
Well, what a great question. So for me and my understanding, how my teachers, how my elders have taught me, it's really important to maintain this connection to our ancestors. And when one understands the Anishinaabe language, the Ojibwe language, we understand the world as our ancestors understand it. And so there are a lot of really beautiful and helpful teachings. And somebody can live, so an Ojibwe person can live a more fulfilling Ojibwe life by knowing our values, knowing our language.
I wanted to ask about your work as a filmmaker, not just as a Star Wars actor. What kind of projects have you done or are you working on?
So I've worked on, as a producer, several short films, for example, several inspiring short films. One of my films is on language and identity called This Is Who I Am. And that's inspired folks to dive into their heritage language or any other responsibilities for their cultures. And that's taken a life of its own, that film. And it's really helped a lot of people. I'm also working on some scripts, some full feature scripts, and looking forward to joining more films as a voice actor or actor in the future.
For anybody out there listening who might think about a career in films, what would you say to encourage them to do maybe something like this Star Wars dubbing project or to do things that bring, as you said, their own heritage language, whether that's Ojibwe or something else?
Yeah. So a lot of minority languages, they need support and, you know, depending on the given culture. So some cultures are more closed to outsiders learning their language, yet others are very encouraging. And so if somebody wants to support a minority language, looking to the elders, for instance, hey, would it be okay to help learn your language? That would be great. There are a lot of languages that need more funding sources. So if somebody has money to donate, by all means, that could be very helpful. And for filmmaking in itself, supporting these languages or finding some other really important message, really important story out there that needs to be told, that's something worth exploring.
Okay, now if I was in charge of things and we had an Ojibwe language version of Star Wars, my logical next step would be an Ojibwe language version of Empire Strikes Back. If that happened, Nagani, what role or roles would you want to take from that? Red Leader, spoiler alert, he doesn't appear in it, but there are many other roles. Who would you want to be in that one?
What a great question. So some of the key characters are already taken if the folks in episode 4 move on to episode 5. And so Yoda comes up in episode 5. That would be fun to explore.
You got a lot of good options here.
There are so many good options. Production team, I'm ready and willing to be one of these roles.
Nagani, can you hit us with a couple of your lines as Red Leader in Ojibwe?
Absolutely. How about Bungatoon Red 2? That's Cut Chatter Red 2. Asha Giga. Asha Giga.
Now, I could tell by your inflection there, that's almost there. I know the movie well enough. Yeah,
you captured
Red Leader's inflection there. That's great.
All for you.
Nagani, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing this work with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Nagani Anamiki Anini is a Wisconsin-based filmmaker and member of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians. He plays a role in the new Ojibwe version of the original Star Wars movie that's streaming soon on Disney+. Do you like to be scared? If so, this is the season for you with scary movies and maybe a trip to your local haunted house.
Later this week, we'll hear about a Sheboygan haunted house that's celebrating its 50th anniversary, half century of scaring people this year, and we want to hear from you.
Do you like to go to haunted houses? Do you have a favorite, maybe a local one you want to put in a plug for?
Or are they simply too scary for you to even think about going?
Either way, let us know. Call 888-642-0232 and leave a message. That's 888-642-0232. Or you can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.